starting. Hello, this is Patrick from the Polish-Lithuanian... this is Patrick from the Fundamental Principle. We're here to talk today about the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth with Dr. Raphael Johnson. Thank you for coming on, sir.
Yeah, I finally made it. This is, been one of my favorite topics for a long time. It's intimately connected with Russian history. And, of course, you have to talk about the Jews here, or you can't really discuss the issue.
Yeah, absolutely. It seems to be the case. Dark Enlightenment, Jerome, Dark Enlightenment will come back about 15, 20 minutes. He'll jump in. But I guess we can start with the, where would you like to start? Where you want to give a brief kind of description or a brief summary of the history of Jews in Poland, and we can kind of work our way up into the 1500s.
Well, I'm assuming that your viewers or hearers know who I am.
Yeah.
I have a certain authority in this field. And I do want to mention that we're going through in Pete Kihonia's show, a very similar topics, going through with a fine-tooth comb, Solzhenitsyn's 200 years together. This is a long-term series we're doing. And, of course, he doesn't cover this in a lot of depth because he's mostly 19th, 20th century. But, this, when talking about the Jews, is absolutely essential. I guess the best way to put it is roughly at the end of the Middle Ages, what we would call the Renaissance, I guess, the Polish nobility. Remember, the Polish Empire was an oligarchy. The crown, even during wartime, didn't have much power. And the oligarchs wanted to keep it that way. They met in the legislature called the Sejm. These were the most powerful landed magnates. And typical oligarchs, they didn't care for the common good. They were devious but not intelligent. They were Catholic but, were not particularly well-educated about it. And in order to manage their sprawling estates... Poland was one of the largest empires in Europe at the time, if not the largest, this period of time that we're talking about. They invited the descendants of the Khazars in to manage their estates in huge numbers. This would mean that they wouldn't have to work at this stuff. They had the reputation of being very frivolous, spendthrift-type people. They were military men, if anything, didn't live on their estates. The Jews can handle all the nuts and bolts and would forward the money, meaning that they all went into debt at some point. The nobility was notorious for that. And there was no urban trade for the crown to draw on, like you had in Great Britain, starving the crown of funds, which was very important. And over the next century, the Jews became ridiculously powerful in the Polish Empire. So much so that by around 1600, they called themselves, this was the paradise of the Jews, and that we are so powerful that the Messiah has got to be coming soon. And instead of the Messiah, they got Bogdan Khmelnytsky. Finally, the peasants were treated beyond horribly. Orthodoxy was technically not legal in the empire. But the Jews eventually, over time, manipulated both the peasantry on the one hand, nobles on the other hand, that they came to control, if not own, huge chunks of land. I mean, they dominated the Polish nobles' estates. The only reason that they were kept from bankruptcy was that the Jews would forward the money and they would be protected. Jews were a very privileged and very wealthy class. They didn't speak Polish. They ruled in the Kahal system, a state within a state, maybe 100, 200 people in each one, ruled by a council of elders. That was the heartbeat of Jewish rule. There was no real census. No one knew how many there were. There was a huge number. They were very well armed. They were not to be trifled with. And it was a terrible... an unsustainable but terrible alliance between the nobility and the Jews. The countervailing force Bogdan Khmelnytsky. It actually occurred before 1648, but the Cossacks were the Orthodox force, military. They called themselves knights. They were founded in order to rescue Christian slaves, particularly Slavic slaves, from the Jewish slave march to the Black Sea, where the Khazars initially got that started many centuries earlier. You had to be Orthodox to be a member. They were generally Slavic. They spoke a Slavic language. They were somewhat nomadic, although they did have their own fortresses in places way down the Dnieper, where no one could get to it. Everything was done on horseback. They were purely mobile, first-class warriors. And it got to the point when the Jews began, they owned the lease on everything. You couldn't go over a bridge. Peasants were growing huge amounts of food and weren't eating very much, just enough to keep them alive, because the regime was getting wealthy on the explosion of population in Western Europe. The grain grown in the East made a fortune for everybody, the middlemen through the Baltic Sea. Peasants were worked to the bone for the sake of maximizing production.
And so, and then what is it, the Corvée labor laws just seemed to be like very abusive in nature, like almost equivalent to like what Israel has today with non-Israelis, just like open an open market for abuse, either physical or sexual.
Well, that's actually a pretty good idea, you know. Arab labor, you know, especially in the occupied territories, you know, that feeds the profits of the Jewish owners. Corvée just refers to any dues. This is not a market transaction. But corvée labor is anything that you would have to do for your overlords. Nothing to do with you personally, but it would be, you know, to fix bridges. It was to work at the household, whatever, a million things that had to be done, because these estates were huge, and there were little countries, some of them quite large, actually, the size of Luxembourg, even larger. You know, the Wisniewskis and so many of these very powerful Polish families. Plus the fact that, you know, a huge portion of what they produced had to go to them, and then that went abroad. Yeah, it was complete and total abuse. The noble wasn't there. They never lived in their estates, or very rarely. No, they dealt with the Jewish overseers constantly, or Poles that they would hire. And the Jews were the tax police. They took a cut of everything that they did, all the money that they collected. And one of the worst things they did, and this never went away, not even right up until the late 19th century in Russia, they controlled the liquor trade. They had a monopoly on it, in fact. And there were so many nasty ways that they would ply the peasantry with alcohol, something that the Russian government was the only one that was able to do anything about. But it was very hard to enforce. They didn't have last names. The Kahal was very secretive. And it's not just alcohol and all the labor that went into it. It was the system of taverns. I guess your tavern back then was as close as you can come to a brothel. And it was almost designed, you know, getting white slaves in there, sometimes for a repayment of debt. They were taking anything that wasn't nailed down. To be a peasant at the time, they were mostly, you know, there were Poles, but we're talking about it was the southern parts of the empire, Ukraine, Orthodox. That was an extra layer of division. And now the religion was gone. The Jews owned the churches. And that was one of the last straws, where you couldn't use it. You couldn't get baptized unless you paid the Jew, the Kahal, a certain amount of money, money that you didn't have. Before you know it, the debt was so high, the Jews thought that they could do anything, including take people and work them in the taverns, on and on and on. Just use your imagination. I guarantee you, your imagination, it's going to be far worse than what you could think. It's amazing how the complaints against the Jews were the same everywhere. It was the same kind of thing. Every kind of dishonest practice you could imagine with a peasantry that they were devious in their own way, but they were no match for the Jews. And if worse came to worse, they'd call on the Poles to take care of things militarily until the Cossacks showed up.
So the Kahal, that was, and you've talked about this with Pete. It was the almost the ghettoization of Jews by their own rabbis, and it was a network of rabbis.
Well, they were localized. They were institutions. There were a bunch of them. They did have a council. We even talked about where it was. I get the two empires mixed up, but they had a council that oversaw them. But for the most part, they were autonomous units. They did not speak. They didn't speak Hebrew. They didn't speak Polish. They didn't speak Russian. Only later on did they start speaking in common language. So these people were total aliens. And I guess they spoke just enough to be able to work their diabolical magic. The Kahal was, and it was very stratified by class. You had a wealthy elite who ruled over the poorer and younger Jewish families, and it was very successful because, especially when the Cossacks would rise in rebellion, righteously so, and they would say, "You see what happens? I know you guys are much poorer and you feel yourselves exploited by us. But the minute you step outside of this Kahal, this is what's going to happen. They're going to kill you because they hate you just because you're Jews. Nothing you've ever done. Nothing I've ever done. But they're animals. They're goyim. We have to keep them in their place or they're going to kill all of us." And so they have all these fairy tales and all this stuff that they would tell the kids growing up. And maintaining that intense linguistic cohesion. The Kahal was the heartbeat of Jewish rule, and that's how they maintained their. If you don't speak Polish, if you don't speak Russian, if you don't speak Latin, where are you getting other information from? They had one source of information, and so you could really tell them anything. So they were developing a fanatical group of Jews, even poor Jewish families, who said, "Well, this is much better than having a Cossack find us," which might be true. But it was far worse. The stories they told were far worse than that. It kept Jews who even may have hated the Kahal in line. Cohesion was by far the most important weapon that they had. And therefore, their isolation, deliberate isolation, which the Russian Empire tried to break and didn't quite do it, their isolation was the source of their power because they acted as one body. They may have hated each other, but the last thing they would do was ever side with a Christian peasant over their own people, not in a million years.
And just a brief reading, it looked like it was the Emperor Stephen Bathory that tried to crack down on either the Kahal or the abuses of the nobility. Was that he effective any of that? Screaming in the wind with how much finance the Kahal had. I saw he brought back the Jesuits. They were the big bulwark against Talmudic forces prior to the 20th century.
Rome on the one hand, the Catholic Church in Poland on the other, were often at odds. And the Jesuits, their great strengths were that they were as isolated as the Kahal was. And they didn't have to listen to anybody. They answered only to the Pope of Rome. But they were fighting the nobility. They were also fighting the church in Poland itself that tended to be of noble background. So that relationship was very rocky. They were well aware. They did nothing to break that relationship. The money was just too good. The relationship, at least in the short term, from the nobility was perfect. You could do whatever you want. You get paid. They take care of everything. They don't complain. They get a cut of everything. We're good. They probably had no clue of how much debt they were in. and how totally unsustainable this system was. But the Jesuit role, they were the educated force. There weren't enough of them. And they made matters worse because they tried to simply impose Catholicism on the Orthodox. They were even, the Polish church was even against the Uniates, the so-called Byzantine Rite Catholics. They wanted to just Latinize them entirely. So you had all different kinds of opinion there. Jesuits did not trust this relationship, but they weren't strong enough, and there weren't enough of them to break it. But yeah, they certainly knew, any educated person at the time knew the Talmudic books and the Talmudic mentality.
So it really just seems like a country welded together by outside forces rather than some holistic ethnogenesis.
Remember, the Polish elite saw themselves as Sarmatians, an old nomadic but still Aryan, a group of warriors from the steppe. The Polish peasant...
I think I lost you.
Your own people, even if they're of a lesser class. So it was very easy to exploit the Russo-Ukrainian peasants, because they were Orthodox in large numbers. But in the Polish case, they did have this myth that they were still ethnically quite different. And they had a right to their position given this ancient tribe that they all... it was a real thing. But whether it was quite that simple was another matter. So it was... The best way to put it, it was a Judaic oligarchy that, even without the Cossack rebellions, couldn't have lasted. And the entire thing fell apart starting maybe in the 1760s, a couple hundred years. And, it just got so bad, it became totally unmanageable, and the debt was absolutely out of control. Now, you mentioned Battery, Stefan Battery, but every once in a while you come across a very strong monarch, Sigismund the First, his son Vladislav. Every once in a while you come across it, but there was nothing that was more threatening to the oligarchy than a strong monarchy. In my book called Ukrainian Nationalism, which is a book of history precisely in this period, they were willing to throw whole battles to humiliate the monarch. Because if there's one thing that'll increase the power of a king, it's a one war that he leads. They were willing to pull the plug. You didn't have a standing army in Poland. You had the noble muster. They created what they call confederations. The Confederacy of Bar was a big one. Small groups of noble families. You put them together and they have like a country-sized entity. They would contract with each other to raise an army and go fight the Turks or the Cossacks or whomever. You did not have a standing army. The last thing in the world the oligarchy was going to allow the king to have was a standing army to use. And there was no money for it anyway. So you had no central power. You certainly had a sense of connection, but only amongst the nobles and in Latin for the most part, and in Catholicism. And it was Catholicism that wasn't quite the same as in Rome. They always disagreed. There was always a back and forth between Rome and the church in Poland. But that was pretty normal in a lot of places like Germany. But it's hard to say which... It was irrational, and it eventually came crashing down. But one way or another, it was going to come crashing down anyway. That system of exploitation, of constantly financing debt for the sake of being able to take a cut of it, eventually the prices in grain are going to go down, etc. And it that's not, it's not going to be able to last forever. And that's exactly what happened.
So we just got in Jerome.
Hey, Dr. Johnson, it's a pleasure to finally speak to you again. Many, many years. Going back all the
way. We've spoken before.
Yeah, we have. Voice of Reason days, I've been following you since.
Really?
Yeah.
And that was Rebel Yell.
Yeah, well, and then I co-hosted Rebel Yell many years ago, but now we're doing this project. But
all right,
and our mutual friend Pete, when I asked him about who to talk to about this particular issue, you were the first name that came up, of course, and I've been really enjoying your series on the Schultz and Eason book, but I'm sorry to be late.
I'm in no position to criticize you for that. But anyway, what happened on Sunday? I was telling Pat about it. That's a little disconcerting.
That's all right. It happens, and we're coordinating across several time zones and multiple communities. So I gotta say, I've been listening to you for years and years, and I've learned more from your stuff than I did in college. Truly and honestly. So I just want to say thank you from the bottom of my heart for all the work you've done for the last 15 years or so. I mean,
more like 30, but I really appreciate it. And if you go that far back to the Voice of Reason, so you know my stuff pretty well.
Yeah. Well, it's, I've been around a long time too. And I've been doing shows since probably about 10 years now. And we haven't started recording, but the thing I've learned,
but that's okay.
The thing I've learned more from you than from anybody in particular is that there's no such thing as secularism, right? That's the lie that we tell ourselves in modern America, right? The First Amendment means secularism. It's like, no, that just means state masonry, state atheism, state Judaism. Well,
yeah, and something is going to take the place of God. I mean, Dostoevsky said that. Solzhenitsyn said that. Whatever the regime finds the most profitable, something is going to take the place of God, even if it's just matter, which has the qualities of God in Darwinism.
I hadn't really thought of it that way, but yeah, you're right. That's right. And of course, there's all these different poisonous ideologies that, have taken their place of traditionalism, of an organic religion, east or west, right?
Right.
You can trace the Tridentine Mass to the canon of Rome that was canonized by St. Gregory the Great in, what, the 6th century? This Liturgy of St. John Chrysostom goes back to...
Yeah. Well, before him, yeah.
Well, I mean, both of these, saints were just organizing and regularizing what it had already been there.
Codifiers, yeah.
Right. And so you're dealing with, basically since the dawn of the church, these liturgies have existed. And we replace that with this mechanistic materialist conception that is inherently evil. It inherently rejects God and is therefore evil. And,
You may not know this, or maybe you don't remember this, but I was SSPX in grad school. And in fact, I was excommunicated as a Catholic by Bishop Fabian Bruskowitz in Lincoln in 1996, which was, a point of pride for me. So I learned from both sides.
Bruskowitz was one of the better Novus Ordo bishops, too. People forget that. I'm an Aristotelian, and I know you're a Platonist, so that's kind of where the dividing line falls. Aristotelians tend to go Roman, and Platonists tend to go East. But the thing about what Bruskowitz is trying to do, and all modernists, whether it's the bishop in Constantinople right now,
Bartholomew,
but he's trying to square the circle of being pro-regime and being pro-Christ, and you can't because the regime exists as anti-Christ.
Exactly.
Right. That's the heart of the regime right now is a rejection of Logos, a rejection of Christ, a rejection of the church, a rejection of, and of course, we have our Freemasons and our Satan worshipers, as we've seen in Iowa today, but fundamentally the people who wield the power are the Jews.
I don't think I could have predicted Francis. I mean, they were all pretty bad. Bartholomew's awful. But Francis is almost a caricature
He's the best advertisement for tradition that you know, he one of the Sedevacantist bishops in America, Bishop Dolan, says, you know, he's the best advertisement for Sedevacantism. I know you don't hold that position, but you know, yeah. You know, in you know, in the East, right? Like, we have all of these. There's a small faithful remnant in the East, and then there's a bunch of modernists who are, you know, I mean, is the Greek Church in America even Christian still?
Yeah, they're all right. They have some good monks and things, but I wouldn't trust them. Masonry is very deep. Ecumenism is very deep. It really depends on how close they're going to be to Bartholomew. Every once in a while, you come across a solid person. But, you know, I wouldn't be able to live with myself being a part of this, you know, the new, you know, new calendar, Masonic organization like that. I couldn't do it.
No, not once you know all the stuff you've talked about for the last. When did you start at Voice of Reason? Was it 2008? I was going to say, yeah, I was like late 2010s or late 2000s. So coming up on, you know, 15, easily 15 years, but coming up on 20, really, of doing internet lectures, you know.
Yeah.
Once you understand that, you know, the Masons got their hooks into Peter, the Masons got their hooks into Napoleon, the Jews ran Poland, Lithuania.
Yeah, that's what we've been talking about the last half hour.
Right. Well, what was it, for 150 years? I mean, and I can't remember which lecture of yours it was. You know, I've listened to probably hundreds over the years, but the Sejm, the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth Legislature, was the singularly most incompetent, useless legislature in the history of parliaments.
It was
like it makes our Congress look like functional and active. Just if you could talk about that for a second, just because of how they set it up, how they set it up to, so that Jewish co-workers could run things behind the scenes and had to.
Yeah. We touched on it a little bit in the first half hour, but, you know, and we're still talking, we talked about it for a long time with Pete's Solzhenitsyn thing that I'm doing with him. Poland was an oligarchy. The oligarchs were dedicated to keeping the monarchy as weak as humanly possible. We were talking about the conflict between the church in Poland and the Jesuits, or even Rome itself, which was pretty severe in some cases. That legislature was based entirely on wealth and power. The largest landowners were represented there, and who had their business taken care of. You know, they were quite frivolous. I just said to Patrick, I said, I don't think these guys knew. And in fact, I guarantee it that they had no idea how much debt they were in, that the Jews were taking a huge cut because they were totally dependent on them for all their estate management. And the Kahal was taking a giant cut starting in, like, say, the end of the Renaissance, when grain prices went through the roof. The population of Western Europe went through the roof. That just meant that serfdom became intolerable because they were trying to get every last sheaf they possibly can out of the ground to sell it. And more was taken from the peasant. It was made easier if they were Orthodox, but the same thing goes for the Catholic peasant too. My opinion is Poland had the worst type of serfdom in the world at this period of time, the harshest, the most difficult, and the Jewish angle made it absolutely intolerable. And that's where the Cossacks came in.
Yeah, well, and ever since the war in Ukraine started, I've been talking constantly how this is literally just a Victoria Nuland being salty about a pogrom from 378 years ago. You know, she's just still mad about a pogrom that happened in 1648 because her great-great, however many times, grandfather, you know, wasn't allowed to steal anymore, basically.
That's exactly right.
You know, I know you're of Irish extraction, or at least partially, mm-hmm. and they don't really have, Satan doesn't really have much of the playbook, and these people are, of course, of their father, the devil, right? And they did the same thing in Ireland in the 1840s. You know,
I recommend E. Michael Jones's treatment of the potato famine, because I've never heard or read anything like that before. That was plenty of food.
So they just had to export it all because they needed
cash. They were exporting it all because free trade, this is what they said. Pitt said this. They all said this. Free trade could not be violated. That was the doctrine. So you had soldiers, you know, that state action is okay. Soldiers stationed, you had food going down the river, the Shannon, going out for export and elsewhere. And you had starving peasants watching it with a row of soldiers keeping them from, because this is, well, this is freedom of contract. This is, you know, this is what free trade is. And I used to call, I forget, a long time ago, Ireland was the dark side of the Enlightenment. Ireland was the dark side of the capitalist and scientific revolution because they paid for so much of it. E. Michael Jones's treatment is, even though he's not really a specialist in it, is still one of the most extraordinary. I came across it in Barren Metal, but I'm sure in the magazine he has it. It's really a harrowing description.
Yes, well, and is that any different today? Really, I mean, I've talked about this for years and years, but and I was just listening to today, right? Like you've talked about it as well. The sports gambling that's ubiquitous in America today, right? Well, the reason everyone plays the lottery or feels like if they pay really close, you'd have these men who will spend, you know, treat their fantasy football team like a second job, because they'll place all these bets because they know that they're never going to get ahead in this usurious system, and so they're desperate. You know, you have millions and millions, hundreds of millions of just desperate people who know that there's no way out aside from them like winning the lottery or the equivalent thereof.
And former middle-class people now are in that position.
Right.
I wrote an article, you may have come across it, on, it wasn't that long, they legalized gambling in Pennsylvania 2 years ago, and the explosion, they were on every block. Not just the sports gambling, but you had game rooms opening up. It was everywhere. It's like, you know, when you go to Las Vegas and there's a slot machine in the laundromat. It's not like that much anymore. They consolidated now. But you see these guys lined up at the payday loan. What's the interest rate there? 2,500%, I think. This was the mafia's bread and butter. They get a gambling addict. Well, who's going to loan them money? Them. And you have like David Scatino getting busted out of his business. This is, you know, now it's been replaced by these payday loans. I think 2,000. And compounded at 2,000%. I think that's low. But you're absolutely right. This is all they have. Unemployment, as you know, is far higher than is being reported. It's probably about 20, 22, 23%. Inflation is far higher because prices have been exploding since at least 2005.
Right. My area of expertise, I think we've talked about this in the past, is urbanism and the suburban experiment and how damaging it is to society and to communities and to just people in general, but in particular how it's failed in America. And, you know, we were never really, the 2008 recession never really ended.
Yes.
And if you look at John Williams' Shadow Stats website.
Yeah, I talk about them all the time, and I know you know that.
So if you look at that, you know, inflation is, you know, unemployment's at least 20%. Underemployment's probably another 10%. I having listened to this series you've done with Pete, as well as other things you've done over the years, right, a formulation I came up with recently is that any source of solidarity amongst white, or anybody really, but especially white Christian men, the Jew has to destroy it. Because
absolutely correct. That is the perfect way to put it.
And it's not, and it's whether it's our churches or social clubs or just a neighborhood, because you know, Archimedes said, right, like, give me a place to stand on and a lever long enough and I can move the world, right? So effectively what they've done is said, we can't let these people have any place to stand on. And it doesn't matter whether it's your church or an ethnic club or your economic interests, a union, anything. They just have to destroy all of it. And just like the Slavic peasants were all effectively induced into alcoholism,
right?
In, you know, Poland, Lithuania.
Yeah, we might as well be talking about Poland, Lithuania. I mean, it's a very similar dynamic, just a different age.
Right. Well, and if you know, you're in Pennsylvania, right? Like home of, you know, the Slavic diaspora in the United States, right? Where did all the people from Poland, Lithuania, and the Eastern Holy Roman Empire end up in America? All the Ruthenian churches, all the Galician churches are there in the Pittsburgh area. They were all came to the mines. And I guarantee that the Jews in charge, I guarantee you Governor Shapiro knows, even if the people who were at the gambling thing don't know it, if there's a bunch of Polacks who are, you know, desperate and taking out loans at 650% interest, Governor Shapiro knows that they're Polacks, and his heart burns with hatred for them.
There is not a shred of doubt in my mind. But just for people who don't know, let me fill in on shadow statistics. Many years ago, a group of professional statisticians from the Bureau of Labor Statistics were sick and tired of being forced to lie. And they quit en masse. I don't know the exact numbers, but it was a substantial amount. And they went and formed, and it's a PACE site, I depend on it, Shadow Statistics. And not only do they give you the real numbers, but they explain where it comes from, how they get to it, not only how they get to it, but how the other numbers are manipulated. But I didn't know that about you. I didn't know that you had that specialty. And I know you know, when E. Michael Jones wrote The Slaughter of Cities, that was precisely what he was talking about.
Yeah, that was in many ways my inspiration.
Absolutely. He's inspired many people. The concept being that the wave of immigration from southern Eastern Europe created these communities, Boston, Philadelphia. And because they didn't have birth control, they were growing in huge numbers. They were sending people to Congress. Urban renewal, integration, et cetera, the whole civil rights thing was designed to destroy these, to disperse them, as you well know, to the suburbs and broke their ethnic connections. And now ethnicity is largely symbolic.
Absolutely. If, you know, if you talk about shadow stats here for a second, Dr. Johnson, a friend of mine and I were having a discussion. He and I have been in the same trenches with each other for about 10 years in the same Telegram chat group. And he was like, man, you know, making $100,000 ain't anything anymore. I says, well, when I first started working, I'm in my mid-40s. So when I first started working 30 years ago, $100,000 a year was a lot of money.
Yeah.
But if you plug it into shadow stats, that $100,000 a year from, say, 1996 is now probably 190,000 in real terms.
Oh yeah. Something like that. Yeah.
Right. I mean, like your money's halved in my working lifetime, and I'm not even anywhere close to retiring. Right. I'm only halfway through, you know, working. So it's not going to get any better. And this is one of those things that why I'm find your program so valuable. Is you're constantly pulling examples from history. That, I mean, how many people, I think largely due to your efforts, you know, people know about the Khmelnytsky program uprising. You know, right. Thousands of people know about that and can look at a history and go, okay, well, why were the Cossacks so mad? It says, well, if they had effectively done what heroin dealers had done, or the same tactic that the Sassoons used in to get all of China hooked on opium,
that's right.
The, and the same tactic that the Sacklers used to get all of Americans hooked on oxys, they did the same tactic with vodka in Poland, right? They just flooded the market with cheap booze, made everyone's lives miserable, let them become alcoholic, let them get super in debt, and then, you know, I'm not a violent man, but if I watched you destroy my father's life and then pimp my sister's, and my supposed king let you do it, and I was 14 or 15, and I watched while your friends sexually abused my mom and my sisters, and I had to sit there or the army would shoot me, I think I'd be pretty mad. You know, I think I'd be willing to stab someone over that.
That's a good way. I mean, it's a personal way of putting it, but that's exactly how it was felt at the time. And I guarantee you, even with that lurid description, it was worse at the time. And with Pete, we talked about, as I mentioned, the tavern culture, 100% a Jewish monopoly, and that's where the violations come from. Essentially, you know, of course, we're dealing with a drug. But especially when it was, travelers were on the road, traveling, they tried to break down families, of course, controlling the church through rents. This was, as you said, this was a method of breaking down the one thing they couldn't handle, is that you had this solidarity that the Cossacks were able to help bring together based on both religion and ethnicity. It created the real Ukraine. Because it was a religious battle against this Judaic empire that created real Ukrainian nationalism in the 17th century, not the Jewish crap we're forced to deal with today after 2014, but the real version. And that's why, you know, the Cossacks are one of the enemies of Jews in general, as is the Third Rome or any Rome. Any of the three of them are bitter enemies of the Jew, because this is the bulwark against them. This is the one thing that they can't move.
Right, the catacomb, as the scriptures say. The best bishop in the world, in my opinion, was Bishop Richard Williamson before his
own. Who just passed away, God rest him.
Yes, and he wasn't hated because he said the old mass, although the old mass is inherently anti-Semitic. Mm-hmm. He wasn't hated because he said the occasional spicy thing about race. He was hated because he told the truth about the Jews. And there's 6 million, and they're Kabbalistic, demonic sacrifice. I mean, right. And I know you've encountered this in the past, but anytime you make an argument for anything good, anything that advocates social nationalism, to use your phrase, it only takes like one or two steps, and they're like, but that's just like, you know, Mustache Man. Right. Well, we shouldn't murder babies. I know you've got a long experience in the pro-life movement,
right?
Still active to that in some greater or lesser extent today, just as I am. Right. The second you say, well, maybe we shouldn't incentivize, you know, murdering children and sacrificing them to Moloch, they'll be like, well, then that would mean women could fornicate. Well, yes, of course, that would mean people would have to, whatever. But it's only, well, then that means you're a Nazi. And anytime you make any kind of honest argument dealing with the reality of the world, instantly, you're no more than three steps away from, well, that's a Nazi argument. And then that's supposed to dismiss it entirely, as opposed to, well, wait a second. Why were there Galician men in the SS? You know, the Canadian Parliament just honored him last year or 2 years ago, right? Honored a man who was a Galician man who'd served with the SS. So, well, why were all these Galicians serving with the SS? Why were there Poles and Swedes and English people and Spanish people and French people and Belgian people and Italian people? Why was Quisling in Norway? Why? And, you know, it's because there were every believing Christian understood that Bolshevism was always of the devil, and that so was Judeo-Masonic capitalism.
Yes, who have, you know, quite a bit in common at their fundamentals, and especially advanced capitalism or postmodern capitalism functions very much as the early Soviet Union does, just with cell phones.
Well, yeah,
and you know, they call us this, you know, Nazis, and they don't mean it as a compliment, which is a shame. Right. You know, you can't just say thank you. They but you know, you do that what we always do. You ask them what it means, and you know, they don't know anything. And it's a way short circuiting the brain is a nice way to avoid cognitive dissonance. It's a great way to just eliminate that line of thought. If we tell someone too much, who's not ready for it, and they come to believe it, I mean, we could send them thousands of documents. Their life becomes very difficult. You know, how can they now serve the system that has done this? And so there's a way. Cognitive dissonance is a terrible way to be, especially when you're forced into it. It leads to all kinds of neuroses. One of them is projection. But there is no rational response. The context is out of the question with these people. You know, context is everything. Why was there a Ukrainian support for Hitler for the invasion, or even the notion that Stalin was planning a massive invasion of Central Europe? Very easy to show. Very easy.
John McMeekin proved it conclusively with Stalin.
Absolutely.
There's absolutely no. No possibility of any other interpretation of the facts as they were found in Barbarossa.
Absolutely. Hitler was not ready for an invasion.
No, God, I know you know a lot about this, but for the listeners, there was a delay in Barbarossa for 6 weeks because Mussolini screwed the pooch so bad in the Balkans and Greece that Hitler had to go save Mussolini because the salty oil fields in Romania were basically the only source of domestic energy in Europe at the time, and so they had to delay like 6 weeks for a key campaign or something that ended up costing the war. Because if they'd managed to get to Moscow in 1941, the war would have been over. I believe that, like, from everything that that I've read, and I've read a fair bit, right? Stalin himself says that without the lend-lease support of the United States, they would have lost the war. Between up the Caucasus route from Iran, the British Persia, right? That was a route, right?
Billions of dollars in today's money. That's 40 divisions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
10,000 aircraft that flew from Montana all the way up through Canada, through Alaska, and through Siberia, you know, halfway around the world, literally. So, the movie with Tom Hanks that they recently released a couple years ago, where he was a destroyer captain in the North Atlantic convoy routes. You know, tons and tons of materiel to Newark Angel, right? The one port they had, but that's it. You can't look at any of this and say, well, why go through all this effort?
Yeah, and then after the war, I mean, the Western world built the industrial grid of the USSR in the 20s and 30s.
But knowing that Stalin was killing millions of Christians the whole time.
Absolutely. And Henry Ford, the largest of all people, the biggest Ford plant in the world in Kharkiv in eastern Ukraine, and the entire industry came from that. And then rebuilding it again after the war.
Right.
And of course, Hitler and Franco under a strangling sanctions. And yet Hitler somehow was able to take what really was a third world hole after World War One. And turning it into a first-rate power, not nearly as strong as the Soviet Union militarily, in what, 5 years?
Oh, I put it out on my Telegram channel just today or yesterday. Hitler comes to power in January 1933. In February, the communists try to destroy his government via burning all the parliamentarians alive. In March 24th, the Daily Express ran a headline, "All Judea Declares War on Germany."
Yeah.
So he was under economic, like, just like it's a fiction that the United States is not at war with Russia right now, because we've taken billions of their dollars, we've put them under sanctions, we've given, if you and Patrick are in a fist fight and I hand Patrick a Bowie knife,
yeah,
and you somehow manage to win, and you turn the knife on me, and then you're like, when I you know, I'm sitting there, well, I didn't fight you. You handed the guy who was hitting me in the face a knife. What are you talking about? Right? Like,
yeah. But again, context is not the question. When it comes to the Jewish power, you end up with special pleading. And they at some point will say anything to get out of having to face the facts. How could you possibly write a history of the revolutionary era in Russia or the Soviet Union without mentioning the Jews? And yet it's done every day. It's nonsense what they put out. Or in Central Europe under the Poles. You have a few people, even some mainstream people, who talk about Jewish misbehavior. You do. Sometimes it's just unavoidable. But the Cossacks are still predicted, depicted, as coming from out of nowhere, or the pogroms in the late 19th century for no reason, just out of jealousy because the Jews were doing so well. And you have academics making six figures who are saying this every day and pretend to be historians.
We're coming up on an hour. I'm glad we're hitting this pretty hard with the Cossacks just being the heroes at the end. It looked like they were just fighting for an equal share in Parliament the entire time, trying to do things right.
Yeah, it wasn't necessarily to create an independent country. They wanted Orthodoxy to be legalized. They wanted the Jews to be totally cleared out of Ukraine, which they got for a while. And, you know, to be actually a functional part of the Commonwealth. That was the agenda for a long time. So they were trying to be as reasonable as possible. And the only ally they really had was the monarch. But the monarch didn't have tons of power. The oligarchy, you know, could not handle this. And the Jews were so powerful that, you know, they reconstituted themselves. They went back under Jewish control. And it wasn't until, because the system was so unstable, 1780s, 1790s, or even before, just slightly before then, Poland fell to pieces and was divided between Austria, Prussia, and Russia. No system like that, or ours. It can't stand for very long. It's so inherently irrational. You can't use debt to pay debt and keep doing it for generations and expect nothing to happen. It's short-term profit only. It's this postmodern worship of images, and it's the we talked about the, whether it be the debt of the nobles, the debt of people going to for gambling, their addicts. We've talked about all this stuff in a short period of time, and we're all on the same topic.
You and I think really kind of want to hit home is that you mentioned briefly that even for basic sacraments, the Jews ran the Polish church, and they needed to pay or take a loan out just to get their kids baptized or get them married.
They had the keys, and that was I'm willing to say that was the last straw. Rebellion really began when they were just raising the price, you know. Because, and I think I said this already, but the Jews really thought the Messiah was on his way. And if that's true, then there is no reason to moderate their behavior. Of course, it didn't quite happen. Khmelnytsky happened. But they were so obnoxious by the time Khmelnytsky came around. And there were rebellions before then, but nothing like his. They really thought, well, if the Messiah is coming, then it doesn't matter what we do. We're going to be the rulers of the world in a short time anyway. And the Hasidic movement, a little bit later, came out of this experience. They became awful, too. They were at war with the Kahal, and especially in the Russian Empire, that, you know, maybe this kind of thinking is not a very good one. But now with new Khazaria and what they're building, what they were building in eastern Ukraine that Putin ruined, that there was yet another attempt to build this paradise of the Jews. Because Ukraine in the 90s, right up until 2022, was very similar to the Ukraine under Poland. Very bizarrely similar, I should say.
Well, if nothing else, they have a long memory, right? Yeah. they'll go to the Arch of Titus and flip it off just out of spite. But I think it's important to just as at the time they were dependent on controlling. There's a saying from that part of the world, right? They'll always tell you what happened, but they'll never tell you why.
Yes.
And I personally have been very disappointed in Donald Trump. The second presidency started out off the gate pretty impressive, but it was all for the Jews that are in control. And you can't have, Ben Shapiro, who 20 years ago, I remember because I've been around that long, writing columns in his WorldNet Daily Christian Zionist program or website, which is a shame because Joseph Farah is a Lebanese man. So he's ethnically betraying his people, much like Richard Hanani is today.
That's right.
But Ben Shapiro was calling for the genocide of all Palestinians back in 2006. I mean,
Yeah, it's amazing how the left didn't notice this back then. But right. Now it becomes undeniable.
When he was like 19 or 18 or something. I mean,
this has been going on for 2006 is the year that they withdrew from Gaza and totally isolated it, trying to starve it off. This has been going on for a long time, but only when, after the Hamas invasion, all of a sudden you have these leftists and some of these Jewish groups protesting Israel. They're so full of it. They knew this was going on for a long time, and never did they raise a finger. Yeah, they don't like Netanyahu for a whole bunch of reasons. He made himself very unpopular. But the genocide concept, and I don't use that word very often, it is so blatant in your face now. Israel kills babies. It sounds stupid, but they do, and they knowingly do it.
Well, but they can only do this with American taxpayer money and American bombs and basically control of America and control through that, the control of Western Europe and South Korea and Japan, right? Like, why are all these countries in massive debt and have negative birth rates and bad financial? Well, because we've, for the entirety of my adult life, we've I'm born in the late 70s, so anybody ironically James Earl Carter might have been the only president in my lifetime not to commit a war crime, but the thing that they've done is they've hollowed us out, and anyone who could read an actuarial table could have told you by Reagan's second term that we were headed for a crash in the 2020s because ridiculous pensions for state and local governments and baby boomers retiring, them not having enough kids, Social Security going bankrupt, massive influx of foreigners even then. It's only gotten worse.
Right.
Like anyone who was honest, and I'm a big fan of yours because I've been listening to you for 15 years, and the whole time you've been saying this is going to end in disaster, and this is going to happen, and this is going to happen, and lo and behold, it's not like you enjoy being right about these sorts of things. I can hear I can hear the regret in your voice because you know people are going to suffer, and you don't want that. But the thing that's going to happen is the white Christian male that was so productive that they not only conquered the world, but they fed the world, they innovated, they built things. You've systematically, I know you've got sons that are in their late, teenage and early 20s, sons, right? Like the opportunities you had as a young man versus the opportunities your sons had at that same age, totally different. And not just because you've chosen a path of difficulty, because you were able to get a PhD by going to a real school, and your sons had no such opportunity because they were white men, not because they weren't smart, not because they didn't work hard, not, and I don't know what your sons have been up to, but I know for a fact, right, like the opportunities you had as a young man who's someone who's maybe 10, 15 years older than I am, versus the opportunities your sons had at your age, you know, when you got your PhD in your 20s, completely different. And it's just because Jews have taken over more of our society and they hate white people. Like that's the long
and 2020 was a key year. And not just because of COVID, the make believe George Floyd thing, allowed, if you remember after that, there was no commercial with a white person in it. The mixed race thing, what we were predicting just a few years ago came true just in that year. Governments could do whatever they want, you know, so-called emergency legislation. It was a pretty revolutionary year. Censorship went through the roof. My son was, one of them was with me in demonstrations. He certainly is still one of us. The other's more apolitical. But they're well aware, unfortunately, of this. I hate to tell them that. That, and one of my sons is blonde, of all things. You know, telling them that is heartbreaking. But you can't lie to them. They're going to carve out their own path. But I don't know today. I got my PhD in May of 99. The 90s were okay. I watched what I said. I was very nice. I was very respectful. I was a good student. They liked me personally. That's sort of the stuff that got me through. None of that is going to work today, especially in the big state universities. And even worse, the media that was open to me back then is not open. The typical academic today has no access to all of this information. Google's censored. His library is censored. He has no incentive to talk about it anyway. His journals are censored. He knows about us only based on caricature and mockery. We know their arguments very well, but they don't know ours at all.
Oh, no, Jonathan Haidt's proved that, you know, conclusively. And Haidt is by no means a sympathizer of our cause. But, yeah. You know, someone like yourself, someone like me, you know, but by nature, I just want to, like, teach college classes.
Yeah.
And read. And so, but I couldn't do that because I refused to be dishonest about a subject. And so I, you know, and then, you know, folks go to rustjournal.org and support Dr. Johnson. Right. But like, you know, I've done so in the past. It's only through independent scholars like Dr. Johnson that we're able to get any truth out there at all. Now, thank God for the internet, because that enables people like you and me and Patrick to have a voice, some kind of voice, and probably more of a voice than, you know, you've probably had, you know, tens of thousands of students over the years, or even hundreds of thousands, whereas, you know, now, if you'd stayed at in the university system, you would have had a couple thousand undergraduates, and that's it.
In a career, yeah.
Yeah. And maybe one or two grad students that you'd helped through a PhD.
Right.
And so you have more students and more reach now than you would have in the conventional system. But, you know, it's difficult. It's very difficult. You know,
so we can wrap this up. We're sure. A little over an hour. Thank you, Dr. Johnson, for coming on. As Jerome mentioned, rusjournal.org. And then we can link the rest of your support links and or books in the description of the show. Thank you. Once again, thank you guys for coming on. And we'll catch you guys in the next show.
Thank you so much.
I appreciate it. I appreciate it. Dark Enlightenment, everything you said. It means a lot to me, and I'll be on again soon, hopefully.
Oh, we'd love to have you back. Thank you so much for being here, and we'll have to figure out what the next topic is. But, you know, I strongly, strongly urge everyone to check out the Schultz and Eason series that Dr. Johnson's doing with our friend Pete Kinnornis, because it's just absolutely top-shelf material. There's something like 23, 24 episodes right now, and people should definitely check it out.
It's a college lecture in and of themselves. All right, see ya. And happy Lent, everybody, or fruitful Lent for everybody.